H.P. Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Read and performed by William E. Hart. Chapter 3. A Search and an Evocation. 1. Charles Ward, as we have seen, first learned in 1918 of his descent from Joseph Curwen. That he at once took an intense interest in everything pertaining to the bygone mystery is not to be wondered at. For every vague rumor that he had heard of Curwen now became something vital to himself, in whom flowed Curwen's blood. No spirited and imaginative genealogist could have done otherwise than begin forthwith an avid and systematic collection of Curwen data. In his first delvings there was not the slightest attempt at secrecy, so that even Dr. Lyman hesitates to date the youth's madness from any period before the close of 1919. He talked freely with his family, though his mother was not particularly pleased to own an ancestor like Curwen, and with the officials of the various museums and libraries he visited. In applying to private families for records thought to be in their possession, he made no concealment of his object, and shared the somewhat amused skepticism with which the accounts of the old diarist and letter writers were regarded. He often expressed a keen wonder as to what really had taken place a century and a half before at that Pawtuxet farmhouse whose site he vainly tried to find, and what Joseph Curwen really had been. When he came across the Smith Diary and Archives and encountered the letter from Jedediah Orne, he decided to visit Salem and look up Curwen's early activities and connections there, which he did during the Easter vacation of 1919. At the Essex Institute, which was well known to him from former sojourns in the glamorous old town of crumbling Puritan gables and clustered gambrel roofs, he was very kindly received, and unearthed there a considerable amount of Curwen data. He found that his ancestor was born in Salem Village, now Danvers, 7 miles from town, on the 18th of February, old style, 1662-3, and that he had run away to sea at the age of 15, not appearing again for 9 years, when he returned with the speech, dress, and manners of a native Englishman and settled in Salem proper. At that time he had little to do with his family, but spent most of his hours with the curious books he had brought from Europe, and the strange chemicals which came for him on ships from England, France, and Holland. Certain trips of his into the country were the objects of much local inquisitiveness, and were whisperingly associated with vague rumors of fires on the hills at night. Curwen's only close friends had been one Edward Hutchinson of Salem Village and one Simon Orne of Salem. With these men he was often seen in conference about the common, and visits among them were by no means infrequent. Hutchinson had a house well out toward the woods, and it was not altogether liked by sensitive people because of the sounds heard there at night. He was said to entertain strange visitors, and the lights seen from his windows were not always of the same color. The knowledge he displayed concerning long-dead persons and long-forgotten events was considered distinctly unwholesome, and he disappeared about the time the witchcraft panic began, never to be heard from again. At that time, Joseph Curwen also departed, but his settlement in Providence was soon learned of. Simon Orne lived in Salem until 1720, when his failure to grow visibly old began to excite attention. He thereafter disappeared, though 30 years later his precise counterpart and self-styled son turned up to claim his property. The claim was allowed on the strength of documents in Simon Orne's known hand, and Jedediah Orne continued to dwell in Salem till 1771. When certain letters from Providence citizens to the Reverend Thomas Barnard and others brought about his quiet removal to parts unknown. Certain documents by and about all of these strange characters were available at the Essex Institute, the courthouse, and the Registry of Deeds, and included both harmless commonplaces such as land titles and bills of sale, and furtive fragments of a more provocative nature. There were 4 or 5 unmistakable allusions to them on the witchcraft trial records, as when one Hepzibah Lawson swore on July 10, 1692, at the court of Oyer and Terminer under Judge Hawthorne that
40 witches and the black men were wont to meet in the woods behind Mr. Hutchinson's house.
And one Amity Howe declared at a session of August 8th before Judge Gedney that
Mr. G.B., Reverend George Burroughs, on that night put the devil his mark upon Bridget S., Jonathan A., Simon O., Deliverance W., Joseph C., Susan P., Mehitable C., and Deborah B.
Then there was a catalog of Hutchinson's uncanny library as found after his disappearance, and an unfinished manuscript in his handwriting, couched in a cipher none could read. Ward had a photostatic copy of this manuscript made, and began to work casually on the cipher as soon as it was delivered to him. After the following August, his labors on the cipher became intense and feverish, and there is reason to believe from his speech and conduct that he hit upon the key before October or November. He never stated, though, whether or not he had succeeded. But of the greatest immediate interest was the Orne material. It took Ward only a short time to prove from identity of penmanship a theme he had already considered established from the text of the letter to Kerwin, namely, that Simon Orne and his supposed son were one and the same person. As Orne had said to his correspondent, it was hardly safe to live too long in Salem. Hence he resorted to a 30-year sojourn abroad, and did not return to claim his lands except as a representative of a new generation. Orne had apparently been careful to destroy most of his correspondence, but the citizens who took action in 1771 found and preserved a few letters and papers which excited their wonder. There were cryptic formulae and diagrams in his and other hands which Ward now either copied with care or had photographed, and one extremely mysterious letter in a chirography that the searcher recognized from items in the Registry of Deeds as positively Joseph Kerwin's. This Kerwin letter, though undated as to the year, was evidently not the one in answer to which Orne had written the confiscated missive, and from internal evidence Ward placed it not much later than 1750. It may not be amiss to give the text in full, as a sample of the style of one whose history was so dark and terrible. The recipient is addressed as Simon, but a line, whether drawn by Kerwin or Orne Ward could not tell, is run through the word.
Providence, 1 May, ut vulgo. Brother, my honored ancient friend, due respects and earnest wishes to him who we serve for your eternal power. I am just come upon that which you ought to know, concerning the matter of the last extremity and what to do regarding it. I am not disposed to follow you in going away on account of my years, for Providence hath not the sharpness of the bay in hunting out uncommon things and bringing to trial. I am tied up in ships and goods, and could not do as you did, besides the which my farm at Pawtuxet hath under it what you know, that would not wait for my coming back as an other. But I am not unready for hard fortunes, as I have told you, and have long worked upon the way of getting back after the last. I last night struck on the words that bring up Yog-Sothoth, and saw for the first time that face spoke of by Ibn Shakabau in the blank. And it said that the third psalm in the Liber Damnatus holds the clockical. With sun in fifth house, Saturn in trine, draw the pentagram of fire, and say the ninth verse thrice. This verse repeat each Rudmus and Hallows Eve, and the thing will breed in the outside spheres. And of the seed of old shall one be born who shall look back, though knowing not what he seeks. Yet will this avail nothing if there be no heir, and if the salts, all the way to make the salts, be not ready for his hand. And here I will own, I have not taken needed steps nor found much. Ye process is plaguy hard to come near, and it uses up such a store of specimens, I am hard put to it to get enough, notwithstanding the sailors I have from the Indies. Ye people about are become curious, but I can stand them off. Ye gentry are worse than the populace, being more circumstantial in their accounts, and more believed in what they tell. That parson and Mr. Merritt have talked some, I am fearful, but no thing so far as dangerous. Ye chemical substances are easy of getting, there being two good chemists in town, Dr. Bowen and Samuel Carew. I am following out what Borellus saith, and have help in Abdul Alhazred his seventh book. Whatever I get, you shall have. And in the meanwhile, do not neglect to make use of the words I have here given. I have them right, but if you desire to see him, employ the writings on the piece of blank that I am putting in this packet. Say thee verses every rude mass and Hallows Eve, and if your line run out not, one shall be in years to come that shall look back and use what salts or stuff for salt you shall leave him. Job 14:14. I rejoice you're again at Salem, and hope I may see you not long hence. I have a good stallion, and am thinking of getting a coach, there being one, Mr. Merritt's, in Providence already, though the roads are bad. If you are disposed to travel, do not pass me by. From Boston take the post road through Dedham, Wrentham, and Attleboro, good taverns being at all these towns. Stop at Mr. Bolcombe's in Wrentham, where the beds are finer than Mr. Hatch's, but eat at the other house, for their cook is better. Turn into Providence by Pawtuxet Falls, and the road past Mr. Sales' tavern. My house opposite Mr. Epenitus Olney's tavern off the town street, first on the north side of Olney's court. Distance from Boston Stone about 44 miles. Sir, I am your old and true friend and servant in Almusen Metreton, Josephus C. To Mr. Simon Orne, Williams Lane, in Salem.
This letter, oddly enough, was what first gave Ward the exact location of Kerwin's Providence home, for none of the records encountered up to that time had been at all specific. The discovery was doubly striking because it indicated as the newer Kerwin house built in 1761 on the site of the old, a dilapidated building still standing in Olney Court and well known to Ward in his antiquarian rambles over Stamper's Hill. The place was indeed only a few squares from his own home on the Great Hill's higher ground, and was now the abode of a Negro family much esteemed for occasional washing, house cleaning, and furnace tending services. To find, in distant Salem, such sudden proof of the significance of this familiar rookery in his own family history was a highly impressive thing to Ward, and he resolved to explore the place immediately upon his return. The more mystical phases of the letter, which he took to be some extravagant kind of symbolism, frankly baffled him, though he noted with a thrill of curiosity that the biblical passage referred to, Job 14:14, was the familiar verse, "If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come."